I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The second presidential debate ended with Hillary Clinton praising Donald Trump's children and Trump praising Clinton as a fighter who never gives up. But the 100 minutes before those compliments were tense and contentious, even hostile, beginning with a non-handshake. Donald Trump said if he wins, he'd hire a special prosecutor and Clinton would be in jail. It began with a question about Trump caught on a hot mic talking about groping women and making lewd and crude comments. He said it was locker room banter and denied he did things that he said on tape and then changed the subject.
If you look at Bill Clinton, far worse, minor words, and his was action. His was what he's done to women. There's never been anybody in the history of politics in this nation that's been so abusive to women. So you can say any way you want to say it, but Bill Clinton was abusive to women. Hillary Clinton attacked those same women and attacked them viciously. Four of them here tonight. One of the women, who is a wonderful woman, at 12 years old, was raped at 12. Her client, she represented, got him off, and she's seen laughing on two separate occasions, laughing at the girl who was raped. Kathy Shelton, that young woman, is here with us tonight.
The fact checkers determined that Hillary Clinton did not laugh at the rape victim. Hillary Clinton said that while she had disagreed with Republicans in the past, she had never questioned their fitness for office and that Donald Trump was different.
He has said that the video doesn't represent who he is, but I think it's clear to anyone who heard it that it represents exactly who he is, because we've seen this throughout the campaign. We have seen him insult women. We've seen him rate women on their appearance, ranking them from 1 to 10. We've seen him embarrass women on TV and on Twitter. We saw him after the first debate spend nearly a week denigrating a former Miss Universe in the harshest, most personal terms. So, yes, this is who Donald Trump is.
That 11-year-old tape was a turning point for many Republicans who turned against Trump over the weekend on endorsing him and some calling for him to resign. Joining us is John Brabender. He's a Republican consultant with with Brabender Cox, Pennsylvania-based consultant. He has worked with many Republicans, including Mike Pence during his run for governor of Indiana. John Brabender, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be here.
Also with us is Ginger Gibson, joining us by Skype, and she's campaign correspondent for Reuters. Ginger, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Reed Wilson joining us by telephone, national correspondent for The Hill. Good morning, Reed.
Hey, Marty.
And Michael Delicarpini here with us in our Philadelphia studio, dean of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, a professor of communications. And Michael Delicarpini, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
John, let me begin with you putting these 3 days together, starting Friday, Saturday, and of course last night. How badly has Donald Trump hurt the Republican Party?
Well, to be honest with you, I think people feel a little bit better today than they did Saturday morning. It was a rough 48 hours starting on Friday. People didn't know what to expect. Certainly, there was a certain amount of shock at what was released. I think you saw that there were a lot of Republicans that issued very tough statements. But I think that to at least stop the bleeding, Trump did an effective job last night of saying, look, I'm certainly not perfect, but let me talk about the imperfections on the other side, and let's start comparing. Are we going to quibble over who said the worst words, or are we going to quibble over who had the worst actions? And let's talk about record and vision. So I do find that there's a little bit more hope today than there certainly was the calls that I was certainly taking over the weekend. And watching that debate last night, everybody thought the Kennedy-Nixon debates were quite tense. I think if we went back and watched those, we would think of this more as like ballroom dancing compared to what we saw last night.
But you do have, I lost count, but I think more than 20 Republicans over the weekend basically unendorsing Trump, saying they're not going to vote for him, calling for him to resign. They're not going to take back what they said, John, based on what happened last night, are they? Or are they?
No, I don't think so, but I think, first of all, and most of the statements, they were also clear in saying that they felt that Hillary Clinton also was not somebody that they could vote for. And so I think they went to great lengths to say they are troubled by Donald Trump's remarks and they are distancing themselves. There's no doubt about it. But they also went to great lengths to say that they don't think Hillary Clinton is credible or should be president of the United States, and this is what troubles them. We saw this even with some very conservative Republican radio hosts and others. But if you notice, there hasn't been any more today. And so that's why I say I think the bleeding has stopped. I think the real key is going to be congressmen and senators in very close races throughout the country. They're going to take a wait and see of what's going on with polling data this week. And I think they'll say, look, if it's stabilized, I'm just going to run my race. If it looks like Trump is really falling, I think there will be more people that distance themselves. But I think they are taking a wait and see attitude.
Ginger, let me turn to you and also Reid and also to you, Michael. Ginger Gibson, Kellyanne Conway said something interesting last night, and she was interviewed about how her candidate did. And then she left this sort of weird, she was asked by Chris Matthews, are you going to stay on for the through the campaign? She said, yes, unless, and left the sort of unless hanging out there. Do you think there are more tapes are going to be more hot mic moments for Donald Trump?
There's a lot of fear within Trump's campaign and within the Republican Party that there are more shoes to drop, that more opposition research is being sat on, and that it's going to get pushed out in the final days or even weeks of the campaign. That's a big fear, and we do see that space being left there. House Speaker Paul Ryan, who sort of very tepidly embraced Trump earlier this year, seems to be putting some space between him and the nominee. And that's because he's got a house to save. I mean, we have seen down ballot races start to be affected by Trump's drop in the polls, something that wasn't happening earlier this year. And when we see these people putting distance, it's because they are concerned. Coming out with a full-throated defense at this point would be a political risk almost no office holder would be willing to take, knowing that it could get worse between now and November 8th.
Reid, what is your take on Donald Trump and his relationship with the GOP and his performance, not just last night, but let's say over the last 16 months?
Well, yes, nobody this morning has broken with Donald Trump yet, but I caution the day is young. In about 45 minutes, House Republicans are going to jump on a conference call has been called by House Speaker Paul Ryan, and I wouldn't be surprised if on that call he says something on the order of do what you have to do to win your reelection race, regardless of what happens at the top of the ticket. Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, I think, are going to have a really tough next couple of days because, you know, Donald Trump did not do anything last night that necessarily would have caused everybody to bolt from the ticket today. But the tape is still out there. And as Ginger just said, there are more tapes that are likely to come. There are, you know, Donald Trump has been a public figure for a very long time, for a couple of decades. There's a lot of B-roll out there that it probably has some other impolitic comments on it. And I don't think he has done anything to essentially get beyond that. I thought last night in the beginning of the debate, the fact that he is sitting there in front of tens of millions of Americans answering for some rhetoric that no other Republican is going to stand up for him on is really damaging. And that's not going away. There's probably going to be more down the line.
What do you think, Michael?
Well, I agree. I mean, it's pretty clear that the damage that was done has been somewhat repaired, but not fully repaired. I think the anger over the revelations remains. And I think what he did do in the debate yesterday is say the difference between him and his example, Bill Clinton, was that his was just what he called locker room banter. I don't think that's the case. But even if that were the case, I think the real issue here is not only is there going to be more revelations from hot mics and videos that are available, but if anyone comes forward and said, well, he actually did do this, then his argument that it was just rhetoric and not behavior falls apart. And I think that could be although I've said this before, that could be the tipping point for him.
John Brabender, I know you have to leave us in just a couple of minutes. One of the things that Donald Trump tweeted after so many Republicans essentially defected, he said so many righteous, self-righteous hypocrites watch their poll numbers go down. It does raise questions about his loyalty to the GOP.
Well, I would argue it raises more questions about his campaigning capabilities. I mean, look, right now is a time where he needs to unify the party to add another wedge in between. There makes no political sense to me, whatever. But, you know, you had mentioned that I'm a former advisor to Mike Pence, and I've listened to Mike Pence have to explain a lot of things Donald Trump does. And he explains it very simply. He says, we try to view everything in the context of somebody who has run a lot of political campaigns and is very politically active and thinks like a politician. Donald Trump does not. And so, therefore, he does things that would be paradoxical to somebody who does run campaigns. But we got to remember one thing. He went up against 17, 18 very credible presidential candidates in the primary and beat every one of them, not through hypnosis, but by delivering a message in a very different style than we've ever been used to. And I think that's why he does have a certain following, is that he doesn't follow protocol. He doesn't do politics as usual.
I know you have to leave us in just a couple of minutes, John. Let me ask you about Senator Pat Toomey. He has basically remained agnostic on Trump. He hasn't said either way. Pennsylvania, a closely watched state. He's in a pretty tough race against Katie McGinty. Is he going to have to choose at some point in the next month about where he stands on Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, I do think a lot of candidates, they're going to be asked over and over again, just tell us, are you going to vote for him or not? And that's going to be the challenge. But Pennsylvania is one of those states where it swings its vote back and forth. You know, Ed Rendell won by 20 points in 2006. Then 4 years later, the Republican wins by 10 points. That's a 30-point swing. And that means people like independence. They don't want just one party or another. Pat Toomey's done always a pretty good job of staying pretty independent. And I think that's going to be a challenge between now and Election Day, is keeping that sort of independent look without, you know, alienating Donald Trump supporters, but not looking like he's embracing Donald Trump. And I'm sure that'll be an important part of the campaign for the next 4 weeks.
And how many Donald Trump supporters in Pennsylvania, John?
Well, look, I mean, the polls have ranged anywhere from Hillary Clinton up by 2 to Hillary Clinton up by 10. But particularly in the western side of the state, where we see a lot of conservative Democrats, Trump is running extremely strong. You know, the Achilles heel for Trump has always been the Philadelphia media market, where you have a lot of more moderate Republican voters, more moderate white college-educated women who oftentimes swing their vote back and forth between Democrat and Republican. That's where he's underperforming. And so, you know, it's a challenge in Pennsylvania, because you can walk into one area where he's remarkably popular and others where you can't go to a neighborhood party and say you're voting for him without a certain amount of mockery. And that's the uniqueness of Pennsylvania. I always say that we're a very parochial state, but we're not a very homogeneous state.
Well, John Brabender, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. Much appreciate it.
Republican consultant, and we're going to take a very short break and stay with our three guests. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about last night's presidential debate, the last 3 days in presidential politics. And again, our guests are Ginger Gibson, campaign correspondent for Reuters, Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, and Michael Deli Carpini, dean of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. I see a lot of comments. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and I'll try to fold those comments into our conversation. Let me talk just a little bit more about last night's debate. And I have to say, as I watched it, and frankly, I was watching probably 3 days of television. I don't normally do that. But it was both dispiriting, engrossing, infuriating, embarrassing, and frankly, depressing weekend in politics. And I just wonder if I'll start with you, Ginger, just your take over the last 3 days of presidential politics.
It is a atmosphere that we are seeing that has never, at least in modern politics, and we can go back to the 1800s and find some really divisive, nasty races. But in modern politics, it's not something that we've seen. You know, I was at my desk all day Saturday, and it occurs to you that I'm writing stories with words in them that I never imagined would print under my name. So we've definitely seen a shift, and we see candidates willing to engage in what are sort of the most vicious character debate that has been seen in years. This is different than previous campaigns. There's a lot of criticism in some circles of last night's debate that there wasn't enough policy substance. It's hard in any debate when 2-minute segments to get into much policy to substance. It's even harder when you're engaging in a character debate to start with. So I think that in the greater picture of presidential campaigns and presidential politics, we're seeing a real standout, unprecedented election that history books will be trying to examine for years to come.
Ray, do you think any minds were changed last night? And the questioners, the few that we heard from, were those undecided voters. But looking at the totality of last night, were the candidates cementing their supporters? Were they appealing to people across party lines? What did you see?
I think we saw two candidates doing very different things. Donald Trump was talking to his base. He does that very effectively and has done that very effectively over the last year and change since he announced his candidacy. But Clinton was talking to a broader segment. She was talking to the middle. And the fact that one candidate is talking to the middle and the other candidate basically isn't, I think, tells you everything you need to know about the state of the race now that we're less than a month to go. I think it was Michael earlier who mentioned the first debate in 1960 when Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy stood on stage in front of TV cameras for the first time. If you go back and take a look at the transcripts of that debate, they're talking about the work that they did in subcommittees in Congress. They're
Amazing.
Talking about specific bills. They're talking about the actual legislative accomplishments that they had achieved. And yet, last night we saw one candidate talking about the other candidate's spouse and sexual assault, and then the other candidate going back to a video of frankly talk that couldn't be broadcast on radio or most television stations. So we've definitely changed the way this election has changed the way we're thinking about politics, not for the best. I mean, one candidate suggested that the other candidate ought to be in jail if he wins. I mean, that's the kind of talk you hear in banana republics, and that's the kind of talk that if it had happened in another country, I feel like the U.S. State Department would issue a warning about threats to democracy.
Michael, I'd like to ask you about the format. It was billed as a town hall debate. It certainly didn't feel like a town hall debate. What was your takeaway from just the setup, the moderators, the questioning, the follow-ups, the interruptions, all of that?
So the town hall debate format was really introduced in presidential elections in 1992 with the Bill Clinton, George W.H. Bush debate. And its format is supposed to be the candidates answering questions directly from uncommitted voters, average voters who are asking questions from their own point of view. This did not have that feel. There's been debates like this since 1992. This is the first one where I felt as if the voters were essentially a prop in which they did ask questions, but in rare cases did you actually see the candidates directly addressing the person who asked the question. They were much more likely than was typically considered doable to move away from what the question was to talk about things that were not part of the question. So it felt all the emotions that you described that you were feeling when you were watching this, I was feeling. And part of that was, I think, because of the artificiality of the setup and how it was basically being ignored.
Is there a better way to do this? We had a guest on Friday saying, just let them go at it and get the moderators out and just lock them in a studio somewhere.
You know, there's a part of me that thinks that those kind of just let the candidates talk debates, I don't think we'll ever see them, but that they would be much better. I'm not sure that would have been the case with these two. I don't think you want to leave these two alone in a room together.
Because just the level of hostility.
I doubt whether what would have come out would have been a more civil conversation. Yes.
Ginger, let me ask you about WikiLeaks. And this kind of got buried in all the news about Donald Trump over the weekend. But WikiLeaks did release some of the speeches and comments that Hillary Clinton had made to Wall Street. There was this reference to what she says in private and what she says in public. How damaging do you think these WikiLeaks have been or are or will be?
I think that moving forward, the WikiLeaks might be one of the last wild cards left in this race. It is important to remember when we talk about this that this was information that was obtained by illegal hacking, that it was public records. It was not data that was released by the State Department. This was something that someone broke into someone's email account. And I always think it's important to remember that when we talk about this information. But it has the potential to really cause a lot of problems for Clinton. The timing by the WikiLeaks on Friday could not have been worse for them. This speech that she gave, in which she talked about public and private positions, she talked about supporting free trade, could have been eaten up the news cycle for days and been all that we were talking about in the lead up to the debate. And instead, we were talking about Donald Trump's video because about an hour later, that came out as well. If there's more, if there's worse segments in there, it could really cause a lot of problems for her. We saw a preview of what her defense is on this front, which is that this is the Russians trying to interfere with our elections, and that is abhorrent. But there's only so much that argument could take her if she ends up revealing something that's really embarrassing in those emails.
You know, when I heard her say, well, I really was talking about Abraham Lincoln, and Trump basically called her a liar, I thought, well, what was she talking about? So I went to the tapes just to find out exactly, or to the transcripts, and yes, indeed, she was talking about the movie Lincoln and how Lincoln basically maneuvered between various public and private statements to get the 13th Amendment passed. So I just wanted to find out for myself if what she said was true or not. Reed, anything you want to add? And I know, Michael, you want to add something as well.
Well, I think this is a good indication of sort of the nuance we lose in the heat of a presidential contest. And frankly, this is what debates are not great for, is we get these sound bites about Lincoln. And there was a lot of skepticism in my Twitter timeline last night, not only from Republicans, but also from Democrats, about whether or not that was in fact the case. And as you said, you go back and actually look at the transcripts. And yes, that is in fact the case of what she was talking about at the moment. But then again, aside from that, I mean, talking about real politics and sort of what is going to face the next president, let's talk about the Affordable Care Act for a second. You know, President Obama's signature domestic legislative achievement. It does not matter who the president is next. That president, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, is going to have to deal with the fallout of the Affordable Care Act and some of the parts that aren't working terribly well. Somebody's going to have to do something. We heard zero plan from Donald Trump. Aside from repeal it, he said replace it, but he didn't offer any specifics about how that would be how it would be replaced. We didn't hear any specifics from Hillary Clinton about how she would tinker with the elements of the law that are not working as they were supposed to, and how she would work with a recalcitrant Republican Congress that has tried to repeal it 50 times. So the fact is, you know, these debates are not great at that sort of level of nuance, that level of policy discussion, and you know, a town hall meeting. A town hall format has generally in the past been good for fleshing out some of those details because a presidential candidate is not talking to a moderator. They're talking to real voters. And that was really lost last night.
Michael, I know you want to add something.
Yeah, I just want to sort of build off of the two great observations that we just heard. On the issue of the fact that the WikiLeaks were the result of hacking, probably by the Russians, and therefore, that's got to be taken into consideration. That's a really important point, but it's also true that the Donald Trump revelations were the result of a hot mic. I mean, I think what we're seeing is the complete loss of privacy, or the line between privacy, private and public, and that whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I think more and more people are having trouble wrapping their heads around what's fair game and what's not. On the issue of the lack of policy discussion and debates not being good for it, I agree with that as well. I do think that there are degrees of that, though, and there certainly are enough really, really important issues underlying the frustration that's leading people to support Donald Trump, for example, or Bernie Sanders in the primary that really need to be discussed. And while debates can't do that perfectly, they certainly could do it better than what we saw last night, I think.
I was thinking that Howard Stern, Access Hollywood, and Julian Assange could determine the results of this particular election. Let me just reintroduce everybody. Michael Deli Carpini is the dean of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, joining us by telephone. And Ginger Gibson, campaign correspondent for Reuters, joining us by Skype. And yes, we are talking about last night's debate, the race for the White House this past weekend. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I'll try to read some comments once we've got them lined up. But let me get Stephanie from Schwenksville to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Stephanie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I really just have a comment that I had decided long ago I'd be voting for Hillary, though not with particular enthusiasm. But last night's debate has really solidified my decision in that, and it's made me far more confident in making, in choosing to vote for her, because I think that she very clearly revealed her experience and knowledge, and that Donald Trump really spoke at an elementary level, kind of just referring to everything as, well, the current policy is disgusting, or, Yeah, so I feel far more confident going in to the booth and voting for Hillary.
And Stephanie, were you on the fence? Were you an undecided voter, or were you just kind of holding your nose?
I wouldn't say holding my nose. Definitely not undecided. It was kind of the lesser of two evils, but I don't feel that way at this point. I think that she's equipped and able to run this country.
Oh, I appreciate the call. Michael, I know you want to add something.
Yeah, I think that Stephanie's reaction it's my sense that that's what these debates are doing, that these are two really well-known candidates. Many people, not all people, have kind of made their decision. It feels like the debates, what they're doing, and it's almost as if people are seeing two different debates. They're solidifying that support. The base for Donald Trump, those people who have the base for Hillary Clinton, and those people who have made a decision to vote for Hillary, whether or not they feel strongly about it. And you can watch these very almost Rashomon-like debates and come away feeling like your original decision has been confirmed by these debates.
Ginger, go ahead, Reed.
Let me ask add one quick thing. Stephanie said something that I think is important for Republicans going forward. She said that she was not enthusiastic about voting for Hillary Clinton. Now she is more enthusiastic about that decision. The big problem for Republicans going forward here is an enthusiasm question. If a lot of these Republicans who are abandoning Donald Trump, let's talk about Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, he needs not only Trump voters in the southeastern part of the state, in the central southern part of the state as well, to turn out to reelect him. He also needs voters in the Philadelphia suburbs, people who might be marginally attached Republicans who are voting for a congressman like Jim Gerlach, but not necessarily voting for the most conservative Republicans in who are running this year for reelection. Maybe not voting for Donald Trump, not enthusiastic about him at all. If those people decide to stay home, which is now a real threat, if they think that they have no presidential candidate on the ballot, they're much less likely to vote for Pat Toomey or Jim Gerlach or any of the competitive Republicans who are facing tough Democratic challenges. So as Republicans move forward here, their issue is now convincing voters who are turned off by Donald Trump to go to the polls and save their majority in the U.S. Senate, save their stronger majority in the U.S. House, and that is by no means guaranteed, especially if voters decide they're just done with Donald Trump and they're just not going to vote.
Well, Ginger, picking up on that, and I wonder just then how much the results will depend on, if I can say this, white moderate women in Bucks County. People seem to be saying that that's the demographic that everyone's going for. How much you think women or even white moderate women are going to determine this election?
Yeah, I share your caution there. I always hate to say this election will be decided by white suburban women.
It feels kind of icky to say that, I have to say. Yes, no, go ahead.
It makes it sound like their vote matters more, but that's not the case. The case is that minority women, minorities in general, have largely already made up their minds. They say they're voting for Hillary Clinton. So you look at districts in Philadelphia that are heavily minority, they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And you're right, it's these undecided voters. It is voters who are largely white Republican women in Bucks County or in some of the suburbs around Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, who have traditionally voted Republican, who are part of the Republican coalition and are saying, I can't get on board with Donald Trump. And that's why we say the election hinges on them. Are they going to go home on November 8th and say, I've been a Republican all these years, I'm okay with Donald Trump, I've gotten over my qualms, let me vote for him? Or are they going to say no? And when you look at Pennsylvania, it's such a great example. You've got Pat Toomey in a close Senate race who hasn't endorsed Donald Trump, who sort of is walking this fence today and yesterday, trying to decide whether or not he's gonna get on board or get off board or support him or not support him. Look at a member of Congress like Charlie Dent, who's got a very moderate district, who is a moderate member of Congress, who has been very critical of Donald Trump's statement. That's because his district is one of those districts full of people who just can't get comfortable with this idea of Donald Trump. And I think that for those voters, they're looking at this debate and saying, nothing here made me feel better about Donald Trump. I think if you watched last night's debate and you didn't like Hillary Clinton, you really hate Hillary Clinton, you think Donald Trump won that debate. But those people were going to vote for Donald Trump anyway. If you were one of the people, and I talk to them on a daily basis, who legitimately can't make their mind up between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, he did little to say to you, I'm going to be calm, I'm going to be collected, I'm going to handle issues when they come at me and not get ruffled. Even some of them pointing out the fact that he couldn't stand still for any long period of time last night, causing some concern last night and this morning.
Well, let's take another short break. I know that we all have much more to say. I just have to take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. So, Reed, hold on. And we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. And that's Ginger Gibson. She's campaign correspondent for Reuters. Reed Wilson with us as well, national correspondent for The Hill. And Michael Deli Carpini, dean of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, talking about last night's debate, the race for the White House, this past weekend of scandal and kind of jaw-dropping discussions. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Let me read a bunch of comments, tweets from ATP. POTUS debates are a waste, never decided over policy, just nonsense. Comment from Rick. There really needs to be more detailed conversation about Hillary's emails that were leaked pertaining to her Wall Street speeches. It's hypocrisy. And for the record, I dislike both candidates. I'm going green. An email from Mike from Wilmington. Trump was not just engaging in locker room banter. He was admitting to sexual predation. An email from a New Jersey listener. Yet again, media bias. CNN hosts interrupt Republican during a key attack, just like Crowley in the Romney-Obama debate. An email from Richard. The GOP is a craven political party, no one of substantial political leverage in the GOP. A tweet from Karen. He made his case against her. She remained incredibly composed and coherent in the face of lies, threats, intimidation. She won. So getting a kind of a flavor for a lot of the reaction to last night's debate. Debate. Reed, you wanted to say something right before the break. Do you remember what that was?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that Ginger was right. I was saying Jim Gerlach. I meant Charlie Dent.
I was going to correct you to say Jim Gerlach not running, but no.
Sorry about that.
No, that's fair enough. Let me turn first to you, and then I'd like to get Ginger and Reed, and then we'll get some more callers in on the conversation, having to do with just what we watched last night, how the candidates moved around the stage, how they looked when the other one was speaking, all the kind of maybe body language messages that we might have been getting.
I think that's one of the most important things about debates. And again, going back to the 1992 debate, one of the things that made that debate so successful for Bill Clinton and not so successful for George W. H. Bush was that Bill Clinton used the stage extremely effectively. He would walk around, move towards the person who asked the question, engage them personally. You, right or wrong, true or not, you get a sense of a person who can interact with average people and who cares about average people. In this debate, especially in the context of the revelations from the hot mic, the body language, I think was really problematic. Not great for either of them because they didn't really directly, except in a few occasions, talk to the question asks themselves, but in particular, Donald Trump's kind of looming, caged animal-like presence where he was walking around the stage, pacing around the stage, standing directly behind Hillary Clinton. It to me, that body, and again, I could be biased, but to me, that body language was such that it really worked against the image that was at that moment particularly problematic. In a different setting, that could have looked very powerful, but in this setting, it looked threatening to me.
How much do you think that mattered, Reed?
Oh, I think it matters a lot. Look, a debate is not just a 90-minute interaction between the two candidates. It is it includes a couple of days beforehand in the lead-up to the debate. Obviously, the tape released on Friday of Donald Trump's comments played a huge role in crafting the early part of the debate. And by the way, the thing that we're talking about after the debate matters a lot as well. We saw that in the first contest where we were talking in the last couple of days about Donald Trump going after the former Miss Universe winner. So what are we going to be talking about in the days afterwards? That shapes public perception of who won the debate as well. I thought in the early moments just after the debate, the sort of consensus was that Donald Trump had done a pretty good job and had stemmed the bleeding. I don't think that's the consensus this morning as we talk more about, as Michael said, his looming behind Hillary Clinton, his comments about putting her in jail, and frankly, the fact that we're still talking about not only the tape itself, but also whatever tapes come out in the next couple of weeks as well. So in the long run of a holistic view of this debate, we're not done crafting what exactly happened and who exactly won.
Ginger, what do you make of the fact that Donald Trump did bring three women and then a woman who had sadly been raped as a child? Hillary Clinton served as the attorney for the woman for the man who raped the woman. But what did you make of the fact that he brought these three women and they had a place at the table, so to speak, sitting in the room last night?
A lot of Republicans were hoping he was not going to make good on his threat to talk about these women. If you look at any series of polling in the past where the infidelities of Bill Clinton have been raised as a point to go after Hillary Clinton, women are more likely to feel sorry for her. They're more likely to say this was not her fault, that she was in fact wronged by her husband, and that she is not to blame. Trump tried to make the case, as did these women, that Hillary Clinton participated in covering it up or attacking these women. On the second front, as you noted, there was a woman who was the tragic victim of a rape as a child. Clinton defended the rapist who pled guilty to that crime. This woman has accused Hillary Clinton of laughing about that case. Clinton has fact-checkers have said that was not true. She did not ever laugh about this case. That's a little bit of a different line of attack. But what I think we're really seeing here, and it all sort of combines together, is Trump trying to throw the kitchen sink, everything he can, at Clinton. And perceptions of this are going to matter. I thought a really sort of strong moment in that there were two sort of strong moments where perception and words sort of collided. One where he said he would put her in jail, and then he was sort of pointing his finger at her and waving it as he talked, an image that likely is to stand out to a lot of women, seeing a man sort of try to talk down to a woman waving his finger. And there was another moment where he referred to her as the devil.
Yeah.
And a woman in the undecided group sitting behind her, you could just see her face sort of respond to the term devil to describe Hillary Clinton. And so those words, those optics are all going to matter. Women are watching, as we've already talked about, and taking cues from what he says. These other women being there, what kind of cues they're giving to women are going to be important, and those optics are all going to matter. And I think Reed is absolutely right when he says we're a little too soon to know how all of this plays out. We saw sort of immediate responses last night that Clinton had won, but how something gets turned into a GIF and shared on people's Facebooks, and then they see over the next 24 hours, we'll cement opinions about that as well.
Michael, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, just on the important point that was just made by both of the other guests, that the outcome of this debate is not over, that what happens afterwards is really important. I want to make the point that that's really important in two ways that are new. One that's new. The typical way is what pundits and political elites say, and the first reaction, the immediate reaction was, well, he stopped the bleeding. But what really matters is what the Twitter sphere, the chatter that takes place and all the various social media we have, how the public is reacting to this. That's going to determine the ultimate spin on this, I think. And I think the jury is really out on that.
Let me see what David from Flemington has to say. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you. I believe the presidential debate should have been stopped after the first one, because little more was going to be learned about the candidates regarding policy, and the effects on the country's morale from the destructive emotional aspects will be long-lasting and very harmful. Thanks, Marty, for letting me express myself.
Sure. Reed, do we still need these debates, do you think?
No, I think we absolutely need these debates. There are a lot of questions about each candidate's actual proposals for the country and the direction they want to take them. I'd love to hear some specifics about what Donald Trump would do aside from ending the carried interest the tax deduction. I'd love to know what Hillary Clinton plans to do about the Affordable Care Act and how to fix the parts of it that aren't working. The problem is we get swept up in these sort of conversations about that David mentioned about each candidate's fitness for office and what they've said in the past and what they've done in the past, which is totally legitimate, and we should be inspecting that and talking about that as we have been for the last 47 minutes or so.
Right.
But, boy, I sure wish the moderators would be able to keep them on task and on track. I thought that the two moderators last night, Martha Raddatz and Anderson Cooper, did a better job of pressing the candidates to actually answer the real questions they were asked. The problem is they just didn't get the results because these two candidates just keep going back to the talking points that they have.
But do you think if this was a policy debate, that none of the scandalous, controversial things that were said last night, if there was this policy debate, there would be that, I don't know how many millions of people tuned in, but I'm assuming it was pretty high. Michael, do you think if it was about NAFTA and about oil policy or the environment or education or all the issues that, of course, are facing the country, that people would tune in and watch that?
The thing about debates is that even though we lament the lack of interest in politics, is that when you look at the audience for debates generally, they're really high. And especially when you look at them across the various networks and the various platforms people can watch them on. I mean, the combination of viewership really matches the major television events like the Super Bowl. And so people do tune in. Would they have watched at this level? Would the same people have watched? I mean, I will admit that there is a reality television component to this that is odd. As you said at the beginning, oddly, it's like watching a train wreck. You're sort of drawn to it. So probably not as much. But I do think it's wrong to say that the American public would not – a fair number of the American public would not tune in to a more substantive debate. Certainly a more civil one, yes.
Let me get James from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, yeah. What I want to mention is as soon as Hillary announced her campaign, she and her campaign do not mention Hillary Rodham Clinton anymore. And two, if she had divorced Bill 20 years ago, could she be running today as Hillary Rodham and get elected?
What?
I think that's what she's built.
Yeah, why does that matter to you, James? Curious.
Well, I'm just curious if that would happen. You know, where she drops saying Hillary Rodham Clinton, you know, I think she just wants to emphasize that she's a Clinton. Okay? And then if she divorced Bill 20 years later, could she just be running as Hillary Rodham and get elected? I'm just curious if anybody has any thoughts on that.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, she, for better or for worse, she stuck by her man. Ginger, is this significant, you think, the fact that she's Hillary Clinton? When I'm taking notes, I always put HRC just because it's easier to put those three letters down. But is that significant?
Yeah, I call her HRC, too, when I take notes, and on Twitter all the time because it's easier to remember that way. I don't think it's significant. I'm going to go out on a limb here as a young, engaged woman who's going to have to decide what to do with their last name. And a lot of women have given me their opinion on this in the last year. It is something some women feel very strongly about. But it is a point that has evolved in our culture. I think in my parents' generation, women not changing their last name or keeping their maiden name hyphenated or part of their middle name was a big deal. Women my age don't feel the same way about that. I think that there has been sort of a cultural opinion shift. Now it's you can do whatever you want and no one minds. And so I think that maybe Hillary Clinton just evolved with the times a little bit. We see less women hyphenating their last names than I think we did in the 80s and the 70s. And so I think we're seeing that. And I don't know that it matters. She can't run from being a Clinton. She's going to be a Clinton no matter what. She could call herself Hillary Smith and we would all still know she's a Clinton. So I at the end of the day, I think it probably just doesn't matter.
Well, I should add that I have a hyphenated last name. I'm still after 40-some years, still ambivalent about it. But no, go ahead, Michael.
Just agree with the point that she could have divorced Bill Clinton and be running as Hillary Rodham, and I can guarantee you that whoever she was running against would be connecting her to Bill Clinton. And the second thing is that it's interesting how much gender is important in this election, not only for the things we've talked about, but if Hillary Rodham were to run and you could separate her from Bill Clinton and just looked at her career, she is one of the most experienced candidates, whether you agree with her or not, whether you would vote for her or not. She certainly has the resume to be a serious, serious candidate for president. And it's interesting that we are talking about Bill Clinton when she's the one who's running for president.
Interesting. An email from Joseph. Why are both Republicans and Democrats shocked over the direction and rhetoric of the campaign? An email from Deborah. I continue to be shocked by the low bar for Donald Trump and the high bar for Hillary Clinton. Let me toss that to you, Reid. Are there different standards for these two candidates?
I think there are absolutely different standards for the two candidates because Donald Trump has changed the sort of tone of the conversation so much. He has been so willing to engage parts of the electorate that, frankly, have been marginalized until now. He has been willing to bring up issues that have so far been taboo, and he has gone over the line so many times, whether it's mocking a disabled reporter or calling for a ban on all Muslim immigration into the U.S. or, I mean, like, how much time do we have left? I can just keep going. The fact is, he has said so many things that would have destroyed any other candidate that here we are talking about, Hillary Clinton's, stage managing, or maybe she wasn't perfect in some answer, or the Lincoln answer was sort of humorous at the time, when we're not talking about the fact that Donald Trump threatened to jail his political opponent on a debate stage in front of, 80 million people. To James's point, by the way, I'll say, if we're talking about whether or not Hillary Clinton would have gotten here, if not for Bill Clinton, would Bill Clinton have gotten where he was without Hillary Clinton? Let's not forget that she played a huge role in getting him elected president the first time. So, yeah, there is a double standard, a sort of different bars that we've set, and that's probably not good for candidates who are planning to run in 2020 or 2024.
Reid, an unfair question because we're almost out of time here, but then as you mentioned this long list, why have they not been disqualifiers for Donald Trump?
Because we're too close to the election. We are now at a point where Republicans are looking at their poll numbers. And I would have loved to keep John Brabender on the phone a little longer to hear what he and a bunch of other folks are saying in campaigns that are polling right now as they're looking or trying to win re-election to Senate races and House races. They have realized that Donald Trump has become the albatross that they so worried about earlier this year. There were a lot of people in the early parts of the summer who were not seeing the negatives that Donald Trump could have brought to the Republican Party. I think now they are seeing that, and that that has essentially led to them jumping ship because of this tape released on Friday when they didn't jump ship earlier because it wasn't that big a threat. I mean, this is politics.
That's Reid Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. Reid, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
You got it.
Ginger Gibson, thank you for joining us as well.
Glad to be with you today.
And again, joining us by Skype, campaign correspondent for Reuters, and Michael Deli Carpini, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And you're welcome. And he's dean of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's a professor of communications. Lots of conversation on our Twitter page and also coming in through Facebook and through our email. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. program and you can carry on this conversation. I'm Marty Moskowitz. Thanks for joining us.